One could say that the inner body is the doorway into spaciousness. So to feel that the life within the body, to feel that is the opening into spaciousness, because it is ultimately, although the body is form and even the invisible energy, that which animates the body, is also form, not as clearly defined as a physical form, but more fluid form. And then you go into that, and then it merges with the, into the form. But we're using words for something that cannot be described through words, but it's enough to say that it's very helpful if you don't want to be drawn continuously into object consciousness, things, to feel the inner body, the aliveness, as the anchor for presence and as the doorway . So when the world comes at you, or the mind comes at you, either from within as your own mind, or from without as somebody else's mind, it's the same human mind, or even the collective mind, you're watching the news on television, stay connected with the inner body. And then you're meeting the world through stillness. And then that has an effect even on that which you perceive. Anything that you perceive, that you meet through any situation, even the world situation. Watching the news through stillness. And the news, of course, is designed to agitate you, to everybody there is having a good time, having a bad time. A question here on the world situation, as is sometimes asked. It seems that the momentum of insanity is growing stronger in the world these days. Any pointers to help us be intensely alert and present as the insanity grows and grows? As you can notice, the answer is already in the question. And then whatever you do on external level can come out of that. It doesn't mean necessarily that you're inactive. You may take part in a demonstration in stillness, or you may go and join the war in stillness. Well, it's unlikely that that would come out of stillness, but who knows? It has to be like that, a simultaneous movement of the old consciousness, totally identified with form, with ego, collective egos, personalized egos, that is has to run its course, and it has to get more and more mad. That's its natural course. And so on the surface, there seems to be a deterioration. And that's at the same time, there's also an acceleration of the arising presence of new consciousness, which you don't always, or very rarely, see on the television. Very rarely. But it's there. You can get little hints of it if you look carefully. For example, you may have seen the past weeks or months, the power of now got into famous bestseller lists. And in some publications, they only divide books into fiction and non-fiction. And in those, a few times, I saw together the power of now and another title that is popular at the moment, Bush at War. And they were at one week it was one was ahead, the other week the other was. It seems a safe prediction, however, to say that in 1 or 2 years' time, Bush at War probably won't be available anymore in the bookstores because those books tend to disappear quickly. They're no longer current. Some historians may still look at them. And the power of now will be around for as long as it's needed, and then it'll disappear. And that's good. So, just one or two little hints before we look at some questions. Whenever you interact with the world, notice when you're being dragged along by a mind stream. Notice how some other mind stream, which is ultimately all one mind stream, wants to drag you along, and how very quickly your own mind links into that mind stream and drags you along, and you're in it. Even a simple conversation, it doesn't have to be a heated argument. If you're alert, even in a simple conversation, you can notice how you get into the mind stream and there's no gap anymore, no space. And expressing your viewpoint, opinion. Nothing seems quite harmless. It is harmless in itself, but you are lost in mind, and very easily it can turn into conflict, and often does. So to notice being lost in a mind stream in a simple conversation, so that you bring gaps, space, even into a simple conversation, and that is when you have uttered a statement, come to the end of it. Let go of the statement. Step out of the mind stream into one step back into no mind. Step back. And there's a moment of no thought. Just presence. You've said what you had to say and step back. And it doesn't need to be long. The other person may not even know that, may not even notice it. It doesn't have to be a noticeable, could just be 2 seconds. 3 seconds, stepping, always stepping back. And then you make another statement, perhaps, stepping back. It's always stepping so that you don't get dragged along. So there's continuous spaciousness opening up within the conversation, within the interaction. There are spaces, little spaces. And then as you become familiar with space, so to speak, how could you not be familiar? It's the essence of who you are. As you become familiar with space, then after a while you will notice even as you speak, you are not totally in the grip of that which is being said. It is being said, but it does not absorb the whole of you. It does not absorb your entire consciousness, those statements. There is consciousness and that. And that, initially, it helps just to feel the body, even as you speak, the inner body, the aliveness that anchors you. So some attention is there. It's the opening into spaciousness. The doorway is the inner body, one could say. Words don't really work here. And so, there you play with form and formless. Well, you play with form and are rooted in the formless. And that's a... Don't wait for a critical situation to practice spaciousness. In the most normal interactions, bring in spaciousness. That's your teaching. That's ultimately what being a teacher, a spiritual teacher, means. Ultimately, the spiritual teacher has nothing really to teach on the level of form. He or she may have a few pointers on the level of form, but the teaching, the essence of the teaching, is space. And if you look for anything else in a spiritual teacher, you're going to be sooner or later disappointed or let down, because you're looking to some form to do something for you. But if you know that, then it's beautiful, then it's, one can be grateful for the offering, because ultimately you're only getting a reflection of the essence of who you are, which is space. So all a teacher has to offer is to be there as space or spaciousness. And that is also when you teach the case. If you think that there may be peripherals, there may be certain things that you apply, the modality, as we called it this morning, the modality of whatever work you do may be there, and yet the essence is, say, space. That is what you bring. And then whatever the modality is, you become very effective. And people might think it's the modality that's doing it. Whatever technique you're using, whatever you do, they might think that this is the great thing, without realizing that that's not really it. That which has power, the power to transform, the power to awaken, is space. So that is your function, is to be there as nobody. Somebody gave me a nice little passage on specialness, and this is very true. The ego wants to be special in one way or another. If it cannot be special in victory, it can be still be special in misery, as long as it's special. And so to be there as nobody special, or no, because that means is nobody, simply as spacious consciousness, a field of awareness. That's the essence of the teacher, the teaching. And that's really all that you need. If you have that, the form will come, or maybe there'll be hardly any form, or some form may come for a while. But that's the essence. So Freud, I think, got it a little bit wrong when they, although it's fine, when they asked him, how do you qualify to be a psychoanalyst? And he said, you must have interpreted your own dreams. Well, that's useful too. But what is the essence of being a successful therapist, a healer, counselor, body worker, anything? Is you are the bringer of space. And then it could happen that people confuse the space with a form when they come to you. It can happen too. And they think the form is very special. Because they feel so good when they come to you. Why do they feel good? Because they're meeting themselves. Ultimately, the essence of space is being reflected back. And so they feel, of course it feels good to be yourself. It's the ultimate satchitananda, being consciousness bliss, to be yourself, the being itself. Of course it is beautiful to be yourself, to be enjoying yourself, enjoy in yourself. And so they may come and tell you that you are very special. and then comes another little temptation to you through that, because there still may still be remnants of egoic consciousness in you just waiting for that kind of thing. And then somebody else tells you the same thing again. And more people confirm that, yes, indeed, you're powerful and special. And then something inside you begins to believe that. And what happens? Form identity comes back in a subtle way. And the more form there is in you, the less space there is, or rather, the space becomes, so to speak, obscured again. And then, after a while, they don't come anymore. Or by then you might have built up a reputation, which means many people have in their heads an image of who you are, and then they might come to you because their own image of who they are becomes enhanced through being close to you or in your company. So they may continue to come even after space has been obscured again for reasons of ego enhancement. This is how things can work. When it's good to know that, and then to see when it happens. See, you can be a teacher even without having totally gone beyond ego. There are people who are very effective in what they do. They may be doing body work, they may be doing counseling, they may be doing teaching in some form. They can be very helpful and remain totally clear in the teaching situation. It happens. But when they go home, into their home environment, they get drawn into the old reactive. And with that, and 2 hours ago, they were totally. And it might not even have been an act. It could have been real. Sometimes it's an act, but that you can notice. a funny story. My publisher told me he was calling up a very famous spiritual, of course I won't mention the name, he was calling up a world famous spiritual teacher. The office secretary answered to discuss something about publication, and in the background he could hear screaming. And he said, "Well, what's that?" "Well, that's so-and-so, that's the teacher." He says, and the secretary, "That goes on here all the time. I can't stand it anymore." But I know that this teacher is doing great work. I've listened to some talks and read some books. And she's doing beautiful work. Not at home yet. Not in the office yet. Maybe that comes last. So, it's only when certain areas that are connected with egoic identity are touched, then that could interfere even with the teaching situation. For example, if you were giving counseling sessions to your investment advisor and the stock market is going down and the ego needs someone to blame, many people have fear around those areas. So then you would lose presence in the counseling session. Alertness helps greatly, to be alert within yourself. And if you notice ego in yourself, just the noticing of it, or some egoic reaction, some needing to be special again, and before you know it, it's come out of your mouth. Before you know it, you dropped a name to somebody that, just to show that you know these important people. And you didn't even, it wasn't planned, it just came out. And then you notice it. Or you may notice some reaction in the middle of the reaction. You may suddenly notice what's going on. There's an ego movement here, an old egoic reaction. The moment you notice ego, it's not really ego anymore. It's only a conditioned reaction. A conditioned reaction, could certain conditioned reactions may linger for quite a while inside you and come up when the appropriate triggers come, the egoic, the reaction comes, the conditioned reaction comes. The moment you see it as a conditioned reaction, it may be anger, it may be some kind of automatic mechanism to either protect your self-image or strengthen your self-image, usually one or the other. And the moment you notice it, it's not really ego anymore. It's still a conditioned reaction, but you're not totally identified with it anymore. So it's only when you're totally identified with the conditioned reaction, then it's ego. When you're not totally identified, it's a conditioned reaction. It's not really ego anymore. So that's, and then without the self in it, then the conditioned reaction loses its energy force after a while. It's not being replenished. So these are interesting things. Teaching situations will bring their own kinds of challenges, as every spiritual teacher knows. And quite a few spiritual teachers have succumbed to the challenges. And, well, what does that mean? Does that mean what they taught was never true? No, it doesn't mean that. What they taught came through space consciousness. That the unconditioned consciousness is nobody's property. And it's nobody's attainment. Even to say he has attained enlightenment is a delusion brought about by language. We say he has attained, as if that were something anybody could attain, like now he's got it. It is there in the absence of him or her, in the absence of the egoic person. It shines as the natural state shines. And just as the sun can also be obscured by clouds again, and the sun doesn't mind, and it doesn't mean that the sunshine was all delusion. So and then the clouds come back. So and then people say, well, has he lost it? Well, he never had it, or she never had it, so he can't lose it because you can't have it. It's there as you become transparent, so to speak, to it. The density goes of form, identification with form. So those questions are really irrelevant. They don't make sense. And people say, once you're enlightened, can you lose it again? Well, no, you can't have it, so you can't lose it. So it's happened that people, and after a while, the teaching lost its power because it didn't arise out of space, out of the stillness anymore. And then for a while, they might still teach from memory. But it loses power through that. And then all there may still be the books there, and there may be power in the books that happens. It's fine. So it's not equating realization, spiritual realization, and who the essence of who the teacher is with a form, with a personality that has attained something or could lose it. And so that's important in your relationship with a spiritual teacher, and as many of you are destined also to be, some of you already are, in some ways, in a wider sense, each one of you already is a spiritual teacher, and in a more formal sense, some of you already are spiritual teachers, and many others are destined also because that's the one field where there are many job vacancies. There's a huge demand. So get out of Silicon Valley or wherever they're not producing more vacancies, more. And some people may be here because they lost their jobs there. And so when you teach, then just be very alert, because the egoic patterns in yourself may want to use that in the service of a new found identity. So, just alertness. There's a question here, and then we'll have some questions or comments on perhaps what we talked about this morning, presence, bringing presence into working modalities, or oh, I forgot to bring the letter that somebody gave me. Somebody sent the Power of Now to Prince Charles. Thank you very much. And the office wrote back, the letter was here this morning. Thank you on his behalf for the Power of Now. Whether he's going to read it, I don't know. But well, he seems to be open to spiritual truths. From the little that I know, which is a miracle in itself. Somebody like that, who is not totally absorbed in their identity, that it is a miracle that there is, that an openness remains. without even having gone through extreme suffering, except his marriage, of course. I'm one of those people who feel safe and still in nature or in soft countries like India. Here in the USA, my heart seems limited to accept the noise and constant chatter which is normal everywhere. I feel helpless by its force. You mentioned bringing spaciousness into this, and I am wanting that and accept the challenge. Yet there is some hatred that interferes, keeping me stuck and paralyzed. Can you comment? Well, I suspect the answer is already in this one also, because it is in surrender to whatever is around you and whatever you feel inside yourself. If you can't accept where you are, and of course you can choose a softer part of the States. Some parts of this country are softer than others, to use this term, of course. But you probably won't find India here. But beyond that, if you cannot accept what is around you, first of all, examine that and see whether it's true. When you say, I can't accept the harshness of this, I can't accept the noisiness of this place, the harshness of this place. And when you say that, or when you think that, stop for a moment and see whether that is true. Or whether that is a conditioned thought that tells you something that you believe in. I can't accept this. And then, as you believe in that thought completely, that I cannot accept this, you have the corresponding emotion that comes with not being able to accept this. What is the hatred or anger? And that may start from, first of all, not looking clearly with alertness at a mind movement inside you, and which may not be true when you say, I can't accept this. And if you look closely, then you examine perhaps, what about I'm not willing to accept this? Could that be more true? And very often, when you look closely, you see that what the mind called, I cannot accept this, translated, means, I am not willing to accept this. And that is a great excuse for the ego to feel stuck in resistance. I can't. But if you saw that what it really means is I'm not willing to accept it, then the door opens. Because then the possibility arises for your willingness to accept what it is right here. Doesn't mean you can't move from Detroit to a little town in California or New Mexico, or from Manhattan to Taos, where everybody is into spiritual things. Those places will be softer, but maybe not soft enough for you, but see the shift from I cannot accept this, and I'm not willing to accept this. Usually, that's what it is. And if you don't see the truth of it, and your mind insists that no, it's not unwilling, it's just I can't. Well, what do you do then is have space around that. Have space around the fact that you cannot accept it. Have space around the anger or the hatred that you feel. It is as it is. So by saying accept that then, it seems almost impossible. How can I accept the fact that I cannot accept? But you can. You can accept that this is how you feel, and this is what your mind is saying. And so what can you do with that, with the anger you feel of having to be here? I'd rather be in India, not here. This is a harsh and noisy place. I hate everybody. And you're not being released. You could go to India, but for some reason you're here. I don't know the reason. But for some reason, you're not being released to go to India. If it were of overriding importance, somehow you would manage to go and live in India and be happy forever after. Now, to some people, the opposite happens. They are happy here, and when they travel to India, they can't wait to get out. And then they say, I can't accept this. It's awful. Similar, often what people learn there is they are not willing to accept it, so they suffer. So whenever that arises, I can't accept, see which statement is more true. I can't accept, or I'm not willing to accept. And if after investigation you find that I cannot is still true for you, then accept that. And whatever emotions go with it, that's what is. And then you have space around it. That space is India. That's the essence of really what India means to you and means perhaps on a universal scale. India stands for the inner dimension, for space. America stands for, one could say, the outer, doing, getting things done, creating on the external level. So you have the two polarities. So when you have space around something, so you have India with you around it. So you could have America being contained by India. And then just a little bit of that is at first you might not get much sense of space around it, just a little. And then you notice there's actually quite a lot of space around whatever you feel, whatever thing you react to, whatever the reaction is. There's actually quite a lot of space there. India is actually quite big. And then you come to a point where you don't need to go to India anymore because you are in India. India is here. America is there. please offer guidelines on doing private sessions. Well, that's what really we've been doing here all the time. The best private sessions are those that come by themselves, organically. You're sitting somewhere, somebody comes, asks, what time is it? You exchange a few words, and then somehow he or she feels impelled to say something, ask you something, and then you say something. Oh, what do you mean by that? Oh, a few words, casual, an encounter, seeming chance encounter. If that is a beautiful, the most beautiful way to, for it to happen by itself. But if you feel you need to have something more formal, put an ad in the paper. Space, sessions on space. There are no guidelines as to how to conduct a session, obviously, because you are there as space. What comes out of that, who can predict at any moment? What form it'll take, if any, nobody can predict. Your only responsibility is to be there as spacious awareness. And then the rest, you don't do it. You don't have to do anything. Just be there as space. And that's a great relief. As long as you think you have to do something, that's troublesome. You get stressed. Before a person arrives, you will get into stress. You think you have to do something. Or before you give a talk, you'll be in great stress. What am I going to say? Are they going to like me? Am I going to transform them? I may have mentioned before the very first talk I ever gave, formal talk to a group invited in London, Theosophical Society invited me to give a talk. And since I'd never given a talk, my little mind said, you better take some notes before the talk. So I had a piece of paper, which I brought with me, put it on the table. There were maybe, don't remember, 35 people. And I talked on spiritual aspects of psychotherapy. That's the kind of thing they wanted. And it went well, and I came to a halt, one of a beautiful pause space. And then the mind said, you better have a look at the paper now. And at that moment I could feel the entire energy field in the room going from presence to mind. So I looked, and then I started again. It was still in mind. It took 5 minutes before presence arose again. And then it happened again. I came to a stop. The mind said, okay, what's the next point? That was the first and last time I think I ever had a piece of paper. It would not have mattered if I'd forgotten 8 out of 10 vitally important points, it would not have mattered. So you will also, I know some of you are also teaching, doing workshops, and it's often the question of structure, to what extent to adhere to the structure, it might already be working for you, and to what extent to step into the unknown, the unknowable, to what extent you step into that space where there's no foothold, no scaffolding. And, of course, that's where the truly powerful teaching arises. Not that you cannot do useful work, even other, but the ultimate awakening, that which has the power to awaken, can only come from presence, stillness, spaciousness, only from that. The other can have the power to make your life a little better, to improve your life here and there, but it won't be the awakening unless you happen to have somebody in your group who is so ready, like a very ripe apple, so ripe that all it requires is a gentle breeze and it falls. And then it could happen that even you might just be giving a quote of the Buddha, and that will do it for that one person. That was the last thing that that person needed to hear. And then that person might say, I awoke in your workshop when I heard the words, all things are intrinsically one. When you quoted those words, I awoke. I thank you forever. And you say, oh, well, so that can happen, but this is would be more rare. The power, that which has the power to awaken comes from, you have to step beyond any agenda. You can still use agenda as the external framework, but within that have the courage to step out into the unknown. And then you could have a, you could still use the name that you use. I have a workshop. You could say you have a workshop on. You could use anything to, and the hidden teaching will be different. You could do a workshop on creating abundance in your life, and that could be the outer framework, but the hidden teaching in there could be something deeper, because the depths of what abundance is Satchitananda. It's the realization of joy, of the joy of being. So you could take that, and then the truth comes. But it is essential to step out of crutches, scaffolding, whatever you want to call it, into this, the openness of space. Step into not knowing. Such beauty in that, to sit before a group with no idea in your head what you're going to say. No, this could be some person's nightmare. But when you become comfortable, it's beautiful. That openness in which there's nobody there. When you don't know anything, you're nobody. Not have the feeling that you know more than these people. You don't. I know I don't. I know that many people in my audiences definitely know more than I. They have read more books, gone to more workshops. I'm sure there are many, don't know what the percentage is, who know more than I. So it's not that I definitely don't know more than they. So it's the less rather than the more. I know less. In fact, I know nothing in that state of spaciousness. And that's you. And it's not only in teaching situations. You can live your life in that way. as an open space and a spaciousness rather than a person. And then they're still on the periphery. Yes, they're still a person. There's still a few characteristics left. There may be a particular way in which you walk, a way in which you gesticulate or speak. That's only the remnants on the external level. A few of these things remain. But the person has become transparent. And that's the only way to be an effective teacher, to be nobody, to know nothing. And then words come. That also means refraining from interpreting, this excessive interpreting that people do in their lives. Whenever they come and meet somebody, go into a new situation, they quickly have to come to some kind of conclusion about this person or this situation or their own, how they relate it to their life or their story. Quickly pronounce judgment upon something or someone. That's how it is. And you've limited yourself to a tiny thought form. It might be true, relatively speaking, but then many other statements would also be true. So to refrain from that excessive interpretation as you go of places and situations and people, just let them be as they are. What for? Why having to put it in some box with a label on it? And so then remain, that spaciousness then remains with you, not just... It's beautiful if you can be spacious and open in a teaching situation, but it is not enough. Otherwise, you'll be like the famous teacher who is shouting in her office and probably shouting even more at home, because home is even more challenging than office for many people. It is very rare in the West to have a teacher who uses no words. They exist in India, people who don't speak at all. You just come into their presence and they look at you. And when you look at them, you know there's nobody there. Not a person is there. Not an identity. Just spacious consciousness. And so there are people who just sit there all day long. Whoever comes, they look at them. Some of them may speak occasionally. Some don't speak at all. And that's enough. If you are open, just need to sit there, look, and transformation happens. But Western people come with a very dense ego. Indians also have ego, but the Western ego is particularly strong. Often Indian egos collapse when they come to a spiritual teacher. Temporarily, true, but they go, oh. Even people who are in their work may be full of ego. They come to a teacher and they go, oh. There is that openness there. Now, it may be that a Westerner is a much harder nut to crack, as some Indian teachers found out, too, especially when they came to the West. They got cracked, and they didn't crack the West. But there is a teacher, there's Mother Meera, I believe, an Indian teacher living in Germany, who very rarely, I think, speaks. She may look at you or give you a hug. And many people come to her. How many people become transformed? I don't know. Perhaps many. But the West also, the Western ego, I believe, needs to be looked at, needs to be seen for what it is, needs to be recognized, and that is why one aspect of this teaching is to point to the ego and see how it works, so that you recognize it when it comes, all those conditioned mind movements. In India, very often they ignore it completely, and sometimes that works. The ego doesn't like that, of course. Some teachings challenge the ego. Some Western teachers do that. Occasionally, in Zen, the tendency. Zen would challenge the ignorance that is ego. A few Indian teachers have done it too, but it's more common in India to ignore it. Some Westerners also, they challenge the ego. Now, when you teach, whether you become one of those teachers who challenges the ignorance in someone else, which merely means identification with conditioned patterns, which is ego, and you challenge that and you attack. If you notice ego in someone, somebody gets up to ask a question, and you notice it is an ego-motivated question. Perhaps the person wants to be special, perhaps the person wants to be right, wants to show that you are wrong, or knows more than you, or knows somebody who is better than you, has met some other teacher, whatever, or some other subtle forms of ego. And so there are certain teachers, when they notice ego in someone, they will attack that person. They're not really attacking the human being. They're attacking the ego form. But it appears to be a confrontational teaching. And that sometimes works for some people. It can crack open the shell of ego. And for others, it doesn't work at all. I look through the ego. Ignore it and look through it. And others might challenge it. Usually people are drawn to whoever teacher they need. Some people need the confrontational teacher. Their ego shell is so hard, there's only two choices left for transformation. Either you go to a very harsh teacher who is almost going to hit you, or actually hits you, or you suffer a lot to crack the shell. If ego is very, very dense, either intense suffering will do it, and perhaps a harsh teacher. Suffering works better usually. Or a combination of the two. You suffer, and then finally you get to a teacher who doesn't leave you any room for silliness, ego, silliness. That's through. The Zen teacher hits you with a stick. When the mind comes up, can you explain again? What did you mean by, and I didn't quite understand your concept of. And that awakens you out of the mind stream. The mind loves to play around with concepts, words, then the question leading to an answer leading to more questions and another question, and figuring out. Any questions? Now nobody wants to ask a question. You have a question. No? Did you? Okay.
I didn't know I was going to be able to ask. In your writings, you say the key is to be in a state of permanent connectedness with the inner body and to feel it at all times. When you're talking about spaciousness, now are you creating that spaciousness by feeling your inner body? And how can you get to the point? I mean, it's been about 3 years every day trying to feel the inner body. And I can go for brief periods, even a couple of hours sometimes, but very rarely. Are you feeling energy flowing at all moments?
Thank you.
Is that what when you had this change, when you woke up that morning, you just felt energy flowing?
Yes, this
continued
to be. Now, the inner body is the opening. It is not an object as such. It is an opening. So because we're using language, it appears as if we were referring to an object that you need to be in touch with, and that's because of the use of language, because every word, whatever you attach a word to, makes it into something. Now, we are talking about a dimension that is not the dimension of things. So words are never quite right. So even to say to be in permanent connectedness with the inner body, I'm glad you asked that, isn't quite right. It was an attempt to say something. It's to be in connectedness with that to which the inner body is an opening, spaciousness. So that is always there in the background, so to speak, and sometimes in the foreground. But it's always there as peace, one could say, a permanent, it's another way of putting it, a permanent field of peace that is not related to whatever happens or doesn't happen out here. So, and yes, there is an aliveness that is there also, part of that in throughout the entire energy field of the body. But it's deeper than that. It's not just feeling an aliveness as I sit here and speak, as the words come, to feel, yes, there is an aliveness in every cell of the body also, but that's not all. There is every word is not quite right. There is beyond that a spaciousness, a sense of space. And I didn't know that at first. If you had asked me when it first happened, the word space never occurred to me. The only word that occurred to me was peace. I saw it as inner, a deep inner peace. So it's good to not get attached too much to one pointer, because then that can mislead you. Peace is just as good. A permanent sense of inner peace. Now, what is peace? Is it just peace, just the absence of conflict? No, peace is something deeper. Peace is a really an alive sense of joy. Alive, still, joyful stillness. Peace. All these things, the words separate things. That's why in India, to describe that state of connectedness with being, with being present in India, they string three words together as if it were a single word. Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat, being, because it's the joy of being. Chit, consciousness, presence. Ananda, bliss. Satchitananda is, because if you separate it into three words, people think there are three things there. But it's one. So we could say space peace or joy space peace. So that, because one pointer usually is not enough and somehow gives you wrong, take several pointers and then forget them. So Yes, there is. I sense the aliveness as even as I speak. There's an aliveness in the body, but there's also a deeper peace behind it, deeper than the aliveness of the body. There's a deep sense of alive peace, and that's always there. But you don't need to look for it. You don't need to look for it. Just looking for it will stop you from finding it, because looking for it creates a movement away from what is. It's to be totally accepting of what is, then it's there. So if you don't have it, you totally accept that you don't have it. And it might not be true at all. It might be a mind movement that tells you, you don't have it. You don't know where it is. Or the mind says, I can't feel the inner body. Is that true? I can't feel the inner body. Not now. I'll try again tomorrow, maybe. I can't feel it now. Is that true? And very often you find, it's not true at all. I can't feel it. So, you don't need to look for peace or joy or even space. You can't really look for it. It is there when you look for nothing except what is now. I was totally miserable, and I stopped wanting it to be any different. So there was a surrender to what is, including everything, unhappiness. Just it is as it is. And then suddenly there was more. There wasn't just that, there was space. But I didn't call it space. So all really that is required of you is to just be with what is right now. Accept what is. Yes, if you can feel the body right now. And usually that's very easy to do. Be careful with the mind. The mind is always looking for something else. Don't look for anything else except what's already here. And if you can just feel the aliveness in your hand, it's enough. Don't need to look for more. Don't look for anything. Can you feel, as you stand there, can you feel an aliveness throughout?
Yes.
That's enough. Just stay with that.
Also, I'm particularly conscious when there's any tension.
Yes.
It's more noticeable than it was years ago.
Yes. Tension is usually unconscious, and when you make it conscious, its lifespan is considerably shorter.
Thank God.
So tension is always produced unconsciously. Because usually a person doesn't say, I'm going to make myself really anxious and tense now. You could. In fact, you could do it as a practice if you wanted to know what it really feels like to be tense. There's even a technique that whatever state you are in, the practitioner will ask you to take it to an extreme. So if the person comes and says, I'm so angry, practitioner says, you're not angry enough, be more angry. Take it to an extreme. Be really angry. Or if the person comes and says, I'm so depressed and sad, he says, be more depressed. Be more sad. Take it to an extreme. And it is true. Anything that you take to an extreme will collapse eventually. So people usually stay unhappy because they don't go to the extreme of unhappiness. They come to a modus vivendi with unhappiness. But if you take unhappiness to an extreme, you cannot actually live with it. That happened to me, fortunately. Unhappiness became so extreme, I couldn't live with it. If it's not extreme, then you can, for the rest of your life, you can be unhappy a lot of the time and be happy being unhappy. The ego quite likes that. So any state, it's something you could play with. I rarely say it. Taking it to an extreme often makes, but it may not be possible to really consciously take it to an extreme, make yourself even more miserable. Maybe not. Life is enough. Life gives you what you need. Can you feel the inner body?
Yes.
Yeah. It's good while you sit here to just, there's not much else to do. be in that. And then you can see that some people feel it more here. That's fine. That's good. There may be certain parts of the body that are more prominent, and that's fine. And then they are perceiving, and then the miracle is that some of you have been experiencing this miracle sitting here. You can be here, present, aware, as the field of awareness, perceive, without the interference of thought. Except occasional little things floating in and out. But mostly just a clarity of perception. And it's a miraculous thing to be able to sit here and perceive this body, this voice, the flowers, the room, and not calling it anything, not interpreting it, letting it be as it is. This means not really being here as a person anymore, just as a consciousness, a field of consciousness, a field of awareness. That's the shift, and you may notice that shift happening in your life more in strange, in the most unlikely situations sometimes. You have the shift from being a person with a past and some needy future and thinking, and suddenly there's a field, even you might be sitting in your office or in your kitchen, and simply a field of aware presence. And then somebody comes into the room, and you're still a field of aware presence. And that person is talking, and you're still a field of aware presence. And then suddenly words come out of the field of aware presence. And they have a different quality. Even if you just say, "Would you like a cup of tea?" It's different. They come out of that. That is love, to see the world like that, to relate to the world like that, to interact like that, is love. I rarely mention love because it's unnecessary. Space comes out of that. It's dangerous the moment you mention it, the mind has a new concept. Okay, I need to be more loving. How can I be more loving? As if you needed to become more loving when the essence of who you are is already that. And the mind says, okay, I have to find, how can I be more? I'll try. I'll have to try and be more loving with this person. It's tough. And then for a while you try, but it's just not quite right. And before you know it, there's an outburst of anger. Oh, I wasn't loving at all. What have I done? You see, then another of these many voices that go on here, another little voice says, You see, you can't be loving. You're a fraud. All that your spiritual stuff is a fraud. See what you're doing. You know that little voice? And it's just a little voice. That's how it operates. It loves doubt. It loves to create doubt. So you don't need to be more loving or more peaceful. You are already that.
Eckhart, how does it happen that we are healthcare professionals here today? Far larger numbers of people are touched by other occupations, and ours seems to be a system which is dissolving.
This is the mainstream healthcare system you're referring to. Yeah.
In America.
Yes.
I don't know about Canada.
Yes. Well, in the entire Western world, it tends to be similar. And most of the world these days is the Western world. So, yes, then this is only one of the many, thank you, the many systems that are manifesting increasingly in signs of dysfunction, where things just don't work anymore. Maybe it worked once, it was fine once, and this is the entire human mind is in that way. The human mind had its place. It was a transition, an evolutionary stage we had to go through, but the products of the human mind, all those things that the human mind produced from its state of disconnectedness with space consciousness, with the stillness, are becoming more and more dysfunctional. So there is the mainstream healthcare system, the pharmaceutical industries, which are producing more and more things and totally dominated or largely dominated by the profit motive. If they found a miracle cure which didn't promise profit, they might not even produce it. And that's only, it's only, they are all these institutions and organizations and corporations, economic, political, social, educational, universities. There are many, many signs of dysfunction where things just don't work anymore. And that's because we are coming to the end of an evolutionary cycle, which is thought, to be exclusively based in thought. And when you come to the end of an evolutionary cycle, any species that comes to the end of an evolutionary cycle, the end will show increasing signs of dysfunction. And that's the simple reason is that you're approaching the end of a cycle. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the human mind. It doesn't mean it never should have happened. No, it was right. It happened. And what is happening now is also absolutely right. But we have to see, and then the dysfunction is there in every individual. It's not just in the structures, the external structures created by the human mind. In every individual, those who do not now step beyond, as you are, but there are still many who are totally trapped in egoic consciousness. There are some young people, especially those that are born to relatively conscious parents, already are born perhaps with more awareness than we ever had when we were born. But that is still a minority. There are still many young people who are born into the ego-dominated environment, and who are begin at a very early age to manifest signs of great unhappiness, of impatience, of continuous restlessness, of hyperactivity, of aggression, even violence or emotional violence. So they are the, in each individual, the dysfunction manifests. Unless that individual has already stepped beyond, is already going through what humanity is destined to go through as a whole. But this is only, you are the beginning. But it's happening very fast. The power of now is read by many, many people now that I could never have foreseen that it would grow so quickly. And it's so many people respond now. Even that is still a minority, yes, but it's enough. It's growing fast. But we need to see the dysfunction is not only in the external structures, but also within each individual. But it's all manifestation of one dysfunction. It's not just in your field where you work. It's in people. It's in the governments. It's in the economy. It's in the corporations, which are just extensions of ego. Nobody to blame, really. Oh, well, it's a pity. It feels so good to blame the greedy CEOs of these corporations. What are they doing? Yeah, of course they are doing it. It just happens, and you can replace it by any other ego, and they would be doing it. It's the same with corrupt governments. Then they have a revolution, and they say, this is the end of corruption. Finally, the people are liberated. A new government moves in, which just means other egos. And 2 or 3 years later, the same corruption, exactly the same, maybe worse. And so there's the ego's need for more in the corporations. All they're interested in is they don't know what they are there for anymore, except they need to produce more. More. So the dysfunction then is only beginning on the external level. It's only beginning, and we will see it more and more of many institutions and organizations and corporations not making it anymore. And increasing conflict and violence as the old consciousness is still playing itself out. Increasing disorientation in individual human beings. Increasing unhappiness, violence, depression, confusion, madness, identifying with mad mind structures, collective belief systems, whether they be religions or political systems. All that happening, different manifestations of the end of a cycle. And that's fine. It cannot be otherwise. And as that happens, the new is already arising. Within the crumbling structure where you and some of you work, this is very beautiful, within the dissolving, crumbling structure where things don't work anymore, something new is already arising, and that is your consciousness is there. Whether, to what extent the old structure will have to collapse, and to what extent a transformation from within is possible, so that it changes from within without a total collapse, we don't know yet. It depends from case to case. In some cases, it'll collapse completely before anything new arises. In other cases, a somewhat more gentle transition, although the dysfunction will be there, but a somewhat more gentle transition may be possible as it changes from within. And as those who represent the old consciousness leave, that could happen. So we cannot predict from institution to institution, corporation to corporation, what form it will take, whether there will be a collapse or a transformation from within. All you can know and be responsible for is yourself, this moment, inner space, at this moment, and respond to whatever this moment requires. You will be there as long as you are needed there. And if there comes to be an incompatibility between who you are and the vibrational frequency of your being, as presence arises, the vibrational frequency changes. And if there is the incompatibility becomes too great between the surrounding energy field where you work and the vibrational frequency of your own, then it may happen that you will be chucked out, remove yourself or be removed by life from those surroundings. But if the surroundings are capable of transformation, then you and others who also have gone or are going through that inner transition, then will draw others in too. And you may remain then, and as the world around you becomes transformed. So it will be interesting to watch what happens. Don't get drawn into fear, anxiety. You cannot underestimate how vital your state of consciousness is in what you experience as the world around you. What a vital part of what you experience as the world your consciousness is. How important that is. To such an extent, the Course in Miracles even says, although don't try to understand that statement, when the question is asked, how many people are needed to save the world? The answer is one. And it's you. You are a microcosm of the entire world. So that which is within you, that power, that is the power of the unmanifested, the source of all, is infinitely greater than anything in the manifested realm, than any structure in the manifested realm. And some of the structures look pretty big, but it's nothing. They're just molecules temporarily arranged as certain structures, but nothing in itself. It can crumble just like that, and many of them will. Gone. Communism looked so deeply entrenched that a totally immobile system, and even the people in it, they were all, you could see the presidents of Russia, or the Politburo, people sitting there, totally entrenched and immobile. And they seemed to be saying, here nothing is going to change ever. The power structures are so deeply entrenched here, nothing here is going to change. Here we are. And then the armies went by with huge rockets and tanks and soldiers. And they greeted. And when you looked, you said, oh, nothing is ever going to shake that. And within a few years, it crumbled. What was that? Gone. And so you look, and then you can look at all that, whatever humans have produced in the manifested realm, it looks can look overpowering, but in itself is nothing. Jesus said there's a little account in the Gospels where they are visiting a town and the disciples of Jesus say, oh, look at this temple, look at these huge boulders, these huge stones on which the temple is built. And Jesus, I don't think the words have come down to us quite accurately. Jesus said, this is nothing, it's just dust. It can crumble in 3 days. It can crumble in 3 seconds. And so it's so easy to become misled into believing that there is a power out there, and perhaps a power that is too overpowering for you, or a power that is threatening you, or that you couldn't possibly change or do anything about. It's nothing compared to, because that which is within you is the very source essence of all life. You are that. And nothing in the manifested realm can be greater than that. Anything manifested is like a dust of smoke, just a whoosh, or a soap bubble compared to that. And so when you see how fleeting, how ephemeral and short-lived the structures are of the world, and now it's becoming easier to see. If you lived in the 19th century, the structure still had a certain heaviness, and there was a certainty in people that their beliefs were correct. There was a certainty. The scientists were certain that they'd solved most of the problems. They knew how the universe worked. Einstein hadn't arrived yet. Newton was there. And they knew that, yes, when the gravity, the apple falls, there are certain laws. Science has all the answers. Before that, there was the religious certainty. Then there was the scientific certainty. There were the monarchies, there were the institutions the people believed in, that countries they believed in, and then certain things happened. And those beliefs crumbled, the institutions crumbled, and now there's the uncertainty. Everything is crumbling, and that's beautiful. That's wonderful. So let it crumble. Nothing. It's simply a transformation, and then eventually a different manifested world will arise, reflecting a different state of consciousness in humans. And it'll be different. I promise you paradise, but it is likely that it will be a more gentle, more loving place, not devoid of polarities, no, but a benevolence to it. So you can actually see what, before you had to travel to India to become aware of how fragile the physical structures are. Because in India, the physical structures are quite loose. Things on the physical level don't work as they should usually, and then even building structures, they seem to be a little bit shaky in many cases. And so people had to travel to India to get a sense of how shaky the material world, the physical universe, actually is. In the West, for a long time, we thought all these structures are this unshakable. Material foundations are unshakable. The structures that we have built up are permanent, unshakable. So the illusion of solidity was very easy to live in, that illusion, if you lived in the West, especially in the so-called highly developed countries, the solidity of the world. And you had your pension plan and your life insurance, and until something happened and you became aware of your own mortality. And for many people that came as a shock. That's why even now in the Western world, death is a taboo to a large extent. Don't talk about that. Let's not talk about death. But then it came to everybody, and suddenly some great shock came. I'm going to die. The world is not as solid as I thought. But often it came quite late in life. Now, as these man-made structures are beginning to show increasing signs of dysfunction, even in the West, we can begin to see that these things are not lasting. We can begin to see how fleeting the physical realm, the phenomenal realm is, how short-lived all structures are. The collapse of the two towers was almost a symbolic thing of that great achievement collapsed completely. There was a similar symbolic thing at the beginning of this century before the First World War, and it was a big ship that sank, Titanic. And people said, this ship is unsinkable. It is a triumph of technology. And its first voyage, it sank. And so to see, when you see that now, more and more around you, that things dissolve and crumble, when you accept that that's how it is, it is in the nature of the physical realm to do that. When you accept that, that is another way of finding, of discovering space consciousness. The awareness of the impermanence of all physical structures, of all the awareness of death, one could say. And when you accept that, what is it that remains when something dissolves? Space. So that's why simply to just to contemplate the fleetingness of forms, to the egoic mind it's fearful, because the egoic mind itself is form. So it's fearful, it doesn't want to look at death, because it sees its own death in it when it looks at something that dies or a structure collapses. But if you can accept that, then you go beyond the egoic reaction and you are with the fact of the impermanence of all structures. And to accept that, suddenly an inner peace arises. When you face death without turning away, without finding some kind of mental explanation for it, but face it completely and see how short-lived everything is out here. Even things that looked so solid, how short-lived, and face that fact. And then in the background, you sense a peace. What really should have been a fearful thing, the ego would say, to face death, isn't that a dreadful thing? No, it's beautiful. Buddhists have known that for a long time. That's Buddhist monks in some traditions, regularly they visit the morgue where dead bodies are kept, and then they said, bring out the dead bodies. And they bring out the dead bodies in the room, and then the monks sit there in meditation for 2 or 3 hours, contemplating the dead bodies. Not thinking about death, just facing death directly. It's one of the deepest meditations, the contemplation of death, of impermanence. And it could be the death of a structure, it could be the death of a body. There's a certain, when you visit a ruin, maybe an old ruin, maybe when you go to Rome or Athens, and that's another, there's a strange sense of peace there when you step into a ruin that perhaps was a building 2,000 years ago, and it's hard now, mostly collapsed, just a little bit left. Peace. A dissolving form in an advanced stage of dissolution. And the more advanced, the more the formless shines through the form. And that's why it's so peaceful when you're truly present to step into an ancient ruin. I mentioned before in a talk, I visited the ruin of a house that burned down maybe 40 years ago in a little park near Malibu and a nature reserve, beautiful surroundings. And at the entrance into the garden, which is also overgrown, and there's the ruins of the house, I saw a little sign. The City Council of Malibu had put it up. And the sign read like an ancient sutra, a holy saying. It wasn't meant to be. It said, "Danger, all structures are unstable." The first word was unnecessary. All structures are unstable is enough. It's not really danger. And that is contained in the word Course in Miracles, which at the beginning is summarized in a few lines. And if you understand those lines, you can forget about the Course. And those lines are, nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. Nothing real can be threatened. Any form, of course, can be threatened. But ultimately, the form is not ultimately real. The life within the form, yes. The unmanifested. But that cannot be threatened. And when it says, herein lies the peace of God, means in knowing this, in this realization, lies the peace of God. The peace of God is the peace that is not derived from form, but from the formless.